Mindhunter, Cassette 7.
On June 21st, Wayne B. Williams was arrested for the murder of Nathaniel Cater. The investigation into the other deaths continued. Bob Ressler and I were at the Hampton Inn near Newport News, Virginia, speaking before a meeting of the Southern States Correctional Association when the arrest was announced. I was just back from England in the Yorkshire Ripper case, and I was talking about my work on serial murder. Back in March, People magazine had run a story about Ressler and me, and that we were tracking the Atlantic killer. In the article, which headquarters had directed us to cooperate with, I'd given elements of the profile, particularly our opinion that the unsub was black. The story'd gotten a lot of attention nationally. So when I took questions from this audience of more than 500 people, someone asked my opinion of the Williams arrest. I gave some of the background on the case, and our involvement with it, and how we'd come up with the profile. I said he fit the profile, and added carefully that if it did turn out to be him, I thought he looked pretty good for a good percentage of the killings. I didn't know the questioner was a reporter, though I'm sure I would have answered the same even if I had. The next day I was quoted in the Newport News Hampton Daily Press as saying, "He looks pretty good for a good percentage of the killings," leaving out my critically important qualifying statement before that. The story hit the newswire, and the next day I was being quoted all over the country, on all the network news programs, in all the major newspapers, including a story in the Atlanta Constitution with the headline, "FBI Man, Williams May Have Slain Many." I was getting calls from everywhere. There were television cameras in the hotel lobby and in the hallway outside my room. Ressler and I had to climb down the fire escape to get out. Back at headquarters, the shit was hitting the fan. It looked like an FBI agent intimately involved with the case had declared Wayne Williams guilty without a trial. Driving back to Quantico, I tried to explain to Unit Chief Larry Monroe on the mobile telephone what had really happened. He and the assistant director, Jim McKenzie, tried to help me out and run interference with OPR, the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility. I remember I was sitting in the upper floor of the library at Quantico, where I used to go to write my profiles in peace and quiet. It also had the advantage of windows to look out of, unlike our subterranean offices. Monroe and McKenzie came up to talk to me. They were both big supporters of mine. I was the only one doing profiling full-time. I was completely burnt out from running all over the place. Atlanta had been a huge emotional drain, and the thanks I got for all of it was the threat of a censure for this statement that was picked up out of context by the media. We'd scored a major triumph for the art of profiling and criminal investigative analysis with this case. Our evaluation of the unsub and what he would do next was right on the money. Everyone was watching us, from the White House on down. I'd stuck my neck way out, and if I screwed up or been wrong, the program would have died. We'd always been told that this job was high risk, high gain. With tears in my eyes, I told Monroe and McKenzie I saw it as high risk, no fucking gain. I said it just wasn't worth it, and threw my case folders down on the table. Jim McKenzie said I was probably right, but they just wanted to help me. When I went to headquarters to appear before OPR, the first thing I had to do was sign a waiver of my rights. Upholding justice in the outside world and practicing it inside are not necessarily the same thing. The first thing they did was whip out the People magazine. Jackie Onassis was on the cover. "Weren't you warned about doing interviews like this?" "No," I said, "the interview had been approved. And at the convention, I was talking about our serial killer research in general when someone brought up the Wayne Williams case. I was careful about the way I phrased my reply. I couldn't help the way it was reported." They raked me over the coals for 4 hours. I had to write out a statement, going over the newspaper reports and what had happened item by item. And when I was finished, they told me nothing and gave me no feedback on what was going to happen to me. I felt as if I'd given the Bureau so much of myself without any reinforcement, sacrificed so many other things, taken so much time away from my family, and now I faced the prospect of being censured, being on the bricks without pay for some period of time, or losing my job altogether. For the next several weeks, I literally didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. That was when my father, Jack, wrote me a letter. In it, he talked about the time he'd been laid off from his job with the Brooklyn Eagle. He, too, had been depressed. He'd been working hard, doing a good job, but also felt he had no control over his life. He explained how he had learned to face what life throws at you and to regroup his inner resources to fight another day. I carried that letter around with me in my briefcase for a long time, long after this incident was over. After 5 months, OPR decided to censure me, asserting that I had been warned after the People article not to talk to the press about pending investigations. The letter of censure came from Director Webster himself. But as pissed off as I was, I didn't have much time to stew about it unless I was prepared to quit altogether. And whatever my feelings about the organization were at that time, the work itself was too important to me. I still had ongoing cases all over the United States, and the Wayne Williams trial was coming up. It was time to fight another day. The Wayne Williams trial began in January 1982 after 6 days of jury selection. The panel they ended up with was predominantly black, 9 women and 3 men. Although we felt he was good for at least 12 of the child killings, Williams was being tried on only 2 murder counts, Nathaniel Cater and Jimmy Ray Payne. Ironically, both of these young men had been in their 20s. Williams was represented by a high-profile legal defense team from Jackson, Mississippi, Jim Kitchens and Al Binder, and a woman from Atlanta, Mary Welcome. Some of the key members of the prosecution were Fulton County Assistant District Attorneys Gordon Miller and Jack Mallard. Because of my work on the investigative phase of the case, the district attorney's office asked me to come down and advise them as the trial progressed. For most of the proceedings, I sat directly behind the prosecution table. If the trial were held today, I would be able to testify as to M.O., signature aspects, and case linkage, as I have in many others. And if there was a conviction, during the penalty phase, I could give a professional opinion on the defendant's dangerousness in the future. But back in 1982, what we did hadn't yet been recognized by the courts, so I could only advise on strategy. Much of the prosecution's case rested on about 700 pieces of hair and fiber evidence, meticulously analyzed by Larry Peterson and Special Agent Hal Deadman, an expert from the FBI lab in Washington. Even though Williams was charged only with the 2 murders, Georgia criminal procedure allowed the state to bring in other linked cases, something that couldn't be done in Mississippi and that the defense didn't seem prepared for. The problem for the prosecution was that Williams was mild-mannered, controlled, well-spoken, and friendly. With his thick glasses, soft features, and delicate hands, he looked more like the Pillsbury Doughboy than a serial killer of children. He had taken to issuing press releases about how he was not guilty and how his arrest was purely racial in nature. Just before the trial began, he said in an interview, "I would compare the FBI to the Keystone Cops, and the Atlanta Police to Car 54, Where Are You?" No one on the prosecution side had any hopes that Williams would take the stand, but I thought he might. From his behavior during the crimes and this type of public statement, I thought he was arrogant and self-confident enough to think he could manipulate the trial the way he'd manipulated the public, the press, and the police. In a closed meeting between the two sides, held in Judge Clarence Cooper's chambers, Al Binder said they were bringing in a prominent forensic psychologist from Phoenix named Michael Brad Bayless to testify that Williams didn't fit the profile and was incapable of the murders. Dr. Bayless had conducted three separate interview examinations with Williams. "Fine," Gordon Miller replied. "You bring him in, and we'll bring in as rebuttal witness an FBI agent who's predicted everything that's happened so far in this case." "Shit, we want to meet him," Binder said. Miller told him I'd been sitting behind the prosecution table for most of the trial. But I did meet with both sides. We used the jury room. I explained my background to the defense and told them if they had any problems with my being an FBI agent or not being a doctor, I could get a psychiatrist we worked with, such as Park Dietz, to study the case, and I felt confident he would testify to the same things. Binder and his associates seemed fascinated by what I had to say. They were cordial and respectful, and Binder even told me his son wanted to be an FBI agent. As it turned out, Bayless never did testify. The week after the trial ended, he told reporters for the Atlanta Journal and Atlanta Constitution newspapers that he believed Williams was emotionally capable of murder, that he had an inadequate personality, and that, in his opinion, the motive in the murders was power and an obsessive need for control. He said that Williams wanted me to do one of two things, and that was to change my report and not say certain things or not testify. He asserted that one of the key problems for the defense was Williams's insistence on controlling everything himself. I found this all extremely interesting, in no small part because it dovetailed so well with the profile Roy Hazelwood and I had come up with. But during the trial, I found another incident equally interesting. Like most of the out-of-town participants, I was staying at the Marriott downtown near the courthouse. One night, I was eating alone in the dining room when this distinguished-looking black man in his mid-40s comes up to my table and introduces himself as Dr. Brad Bayless. I tell him I know who he is and why he's here. He asks if he can sit down. I tell him I think it's a bad idea that we're seen together if he's going to be testifying for the defense tomorrow. But Bayless says he isn't concerned about that, sits down, and asks me what I know about him and his background, which turns out to be quite a lot. I gave him one of my mini-lectures on criminal psychology and comment that if he testifies the way the defense wants him to, he's going to embarrass himself and his profession. When he leaves the table, he shakes my hand and says he'd really like to come to Quantico and take our courses. I kind of wink and say, "We'll see how you do on the stand tomorrow." The next day in court, lo and behold, I find out Dr. Bayless has gone back to Arizona without testifying. At the bench, Binder is complaining about the power of the prosecution and how they're scaring off his expert witnesses. I hadn't set out to do that, if that's what happened, but I certainly wasn't going to back away when the chance fell in my lap. But what really happened, I think, was that Dr. Bayless had too much integrity not to call it as he saw it, or to let himself be used by either side for their own purposes. During the prosecution's case, Hal Dedmon and Larry Peterson had done a masterful job with the hair and fiber evidence, but it was extremely complex stuff, and by its very nature, not a very theatrical presentation. All about how this carpet fiber twists in this direction and that carpet fiber twists in the other direction. Ultimately, they matched fibers from all 12 victims to Williams's violet and green bedspread, connected most of them to the carpet in Williams's bedroom, about half to the carpet in the living room, the same number to his 1970 Chevrolet, and in all but one case were able to make a connection to hair from the defendant's German shepherd, Sheba. When it was the defense's turn, they had a handsome and charming Kennedy look-alike from Kansas who smiled a lot at the jury come in to rebut Dedman's testimony. At the end of the session, when the prosecution team met to go over what had happened that day, everyone was laughing about how this good-looking guy from Kansas had not been at all convincing. They came to me. "What do you think, John?" I'd been watching the jury. I said, "Let me tell you something. You guys are losing the case." They were shocked, and it was the last thing they wanted to hear. "You may not think he was convincing," I explained, "but the jurors believe him." I knew what Hal Dedman was talking about, and I still found it difficult going. The defense witnesses may have been overly simplistic, but they were much easier to follow. They were gracious enough not to tell me I was full of shit, but incisive profiler that I am, I realized I wasn't wanted here. I had a big backlog of cases waiting for me, and I was preparing for the Mary Frances Stoner murder trial. All this time on the road was starting to take its personal toll, too. I was having marital problems based on my lack of involvement with the family. I wasn't getting the exercise I thought I needed. I was stressed all the time. I called Larry Monroe at Quantico and told him I was coming back home. No sooner do I get back to National Airport and drive home than I receive a message saying the prosecutions had second thoughts. They're starting to think some of the things I said may, in fact, be happening. They want me to come back to Atlanta to help them examine the defense witnesses. So, 2 days later, I fly back again. Now they're much more open, asking for advice. And the big surprise to all of them is that Wayne Williams decides to take the stand, which I predicted. He's examined by his attorney, Al Binder, who has a deep, resonant voice. The way he hunches over as he asks questions, he looks like a shark, which is why he has the nickname Jaws. He keeps making the same point to the jury. Look at him. Does he look like a serial killer? Look at him. "Get up, Wayne," he says, telling him to hold out his hands. "Look how soft his hands are. Do you think he would have the strength to kill someone, to strangle someone with these hands?" Binder put Williams on the stand the middle of one day and kept him on all the next day. And Williams did a tremendous job for himself, just as he must have known he would. He was totally believable as the innocent victim of an embarrassed, racially biased system that needed a suspect fast, and had found one. So the next question for the prosecution was, how are we going to cross-examine him? Assistant District Attorney Jack Mallard has the ticket. He's the one on the spot. He has a low, slow voice and a mellifluous southern accent. I didn't have any formal training in courtroom procedure or examination of witnesses, but I had an instinct for what it would take. It was really all based on the idea of walking in the shoes. I asked myself, what would be upsetting to me? And the answer I came up with was to be questioned by someone who just knew I was guilty, regardless of what I tried to make him believe. I said to Mallard, "Remember the old TV show, This Is Your Life? You've got to do that with him. You've got to keep him on the stand as long as you can. You've got to break him down. Because he's an over-controlled, rigid personality. He's an obsessive-compulsive. And to get to that rigidity, you have to keep the pressure on him, sustain the tension by going through every aspect of his life, even stuff that doesn't seem to mean anything, like where he went to school. Just keep it up. Then, when you've worn him down, you have to physically touch him, just like Al Binder did. What's good for the defense is good for the prosecution. Move in close, violate his space, and catch him off guard. Before the defense has the opportunity to object, ask him in a low voice, Did you panic, Wayne, when you killed these kids? And when the time comes, that's just what Mallard does. For the first several hours of cross-examination, he can't rattle Williams. He catches him up in a number of glaring inconsistencies, but it's the same calm. How could it possibly be me, Williams? The gray-haired, gray-suited Mallard methodically goes through his whole life. Then at the right time, he goes in close, puts his hand on Williams's arm, and in a low, methodical South Georgia drawl says, "What was it like, Wayne? What was it like when you wrapped your fingers around the victim's throat? Did you panic? Did you panic?" And in a weak voice of his own, Williams says, "No." Then he catches himself. He flies into a rage. He points his finger at me and screams, "You're trying your best to make me fit that FBI profile, and I'm not going to help you do it." The defense goes ballistic. Williams goes nuts, ranting about FBI goons and calling the prosecution team fools. But that was the turning point of the trial. Jury members later said so themselves. They stared with their mouths open. For the first time, they had seen the other side of Wayne Williams. They could see the metamorphosis before their eyes. They could understand the violence of which he was capable. Mallard winked at me, then went back to hammering Williams on the stand. After his eruption in open court like that, I knew that he knew his only chance was to get back some of the sympathy he'd built up throughout the trial. I tapped Mallard on the shoulder and said, "You watch, Jack. 1 week from today, Wayne's going to get sick." I don't know why I picked the 1 week time frame, but exactly 1 week later, the trial was interrupted and Williams was rushed to the hospital with stomach pains. They found nothing wrong with him and released him. In her statement to the jury, Williams's attorney, Mary Welcome, held up a thimble and asked them, "Are you going to let a thimbleful of evidence convict this man?" She held up a piece of green carpet from her office, saying how common it was. How can you convict a man because he has green carpet? So that day, some other agents and I went to her law firm. We walked in, went into her office while she wasn't there, and pulled up some carpet fibers. We brought them back and had the experts put them under the microscope and gave the evidence to the prosecution, demonstrating that the fibers from her carpet were completely different from the fibers in the carpet in Williams' home. On February 27, 1982, after 11 hours of deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict in both murders. Wayne B. Williams was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms, which he's serving in the Valdosta Correctional Institution in South Georgia. He still maintains his innocence, and the controversy surrounding Williams has never died down or gone away. If he does ever manage to win a new trial, I am confident the result will be the same. Despite what his supporters maintain, I believe the forensic and behavioral evidence points conclusively to Wayne Williams as the killer of 11 young men in Atlanta. Despite what his detractors and accusers maintain, I believe there is no strong evidence linking him to all or even most of the deaths and disappearances of children in that city between 1979 and 1981. Despite what some people would like to believe, young black and white children continue to die mysteriously in Atlanta and other cities. We have an idea who did some of the others. It isn't a single offender, and the truth isn't pleasant. So far, though, there's been neither the evidence nor the public will to seek indictments. I got a number of complimentary letters and citations as a result of my work on the Wayne Williams case, including ones from the Fulton County District Attorney's Office, saying I had come up with the effective cross-examination strategy, and one from John Glover, SAC of the Atlanta field office, summarizing the entire AtKid investigation. One of the most moving and appreciated came from Al Binder, the lead defense attorney, who wrote to say how impressed he was by the job we'd done on the case. These came in just about the time the letter of censure did. Jim McKenzie, very upset about this turn of events, had put me in for an incentive award, not only for the Williams case, but for five other cases I'd contributed to. It came through in May. So now I had a letter of commendation from the director to go with my letter of censure on the same case. It said in part that, through your talent, dedication to duty, and professionalism, you have indeed enhanced the Bureau's fine reputation throughout the nation, and you may be certain that your valuable services are truly appreciated. A substantial cash award of $250 accompanied the commendation, which I figured worked out to about a nickel an hour. I promptly donated the money to the Navy Relief Fund for the benefit of the families of men and women who had died in service to their country. If we were faced with a case like the Atlanta child murders today, I'd like to think we could get to the killer significantly sooner, before the trail of death and suffering was so appallingly long. We would all be much more efficient about coordinating our efforts. Our proactive techniques are more sophisticated and based on far more real-world experience. We would know how to stage the interrogation for maximum effect. We would plan better for the search warrant and get it before critical evidence could be destroyed. But whatever mistakes we made, the AtKid case was a decisive turning point for our unit. We put ourselves on the map, proved the value of what we could do, and in the process, achieved instant credibility throughout the law enforcement community worldwide and helped put another killer behind bars. High risk, high gain. Chapter 12. One of Our Own. Judson Ray is one of the living legends at Quantico. He very nearly wasn't. In February of 1982, while he was working at Kid as a special agent in the Atlanta field office, his wife tried to have him killed. We first became aware of each other, though we didn't meet, during the Forces of Evil case in early 1978. A serial killer dubbed the Stocking Strangler had assaulted six elderly women in Columbus, Georgia, after breaking into their homes, strangling each of them with their own nylon stockings. All of the victims were white, and forensic evidence the medical examiner found on some of the bodies suggested the strangler was black. Then the chief of police received an alarming letter, written on U.S. Army stationery, claiming to be from a group of seven people calling itself the Forces of Evil. The letter made mention of the belief that the stalking strangler was black and threatened to kill a black woman in retaliation if he was not caught by June 1st, or 1 June, as the writer or writers stated it. They claimed already to have abducted a woman named Gail Jackson. If the S. Strangler was not caught by 1 September, the victims will double. The letter suggested that the military stationery had been stolen and that the group originated in Chicago. This development represented everyone's worst nightmare. A brutal killer stalking Columbus was horrible enough. An organized and murderous vigilante reaction to it could tear the community apart. Other letters followed, upping the ante with a further demand for a $10,000 ransom, as the police searched frantically but without success for any of these seven white men. Gail Jackson was a prostitute, well known around the bars that serviced Fort Benning. And she was indeed missing. Judd Ray was a shift commander in the Columbus Police Department. As an Army Vietnam veteran and a black police officer who had worked his way up through the ranks, he was acutely aware that the community would not heal until these twin threats of the Stalking Strangler and the Forces of Evil organization were neutralized. With no progress in the investigation, despite all the time and effort that had gone into it, his cop instincts told him they had to be looking for the wrong people in the wrong way. He tried to keep up on law enforcement developments around the country and had heard about the profiling program in Quantico. He suggested that the department contact the Behavioral Science Unit and see what we made of the case. On March 31st, we were asked through the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to analyze the case. Despite what the original letter had stated, we were all pretty sure the connection to the Army and Fort Benning was not a casual one. Bob Ressler, who'd been a military policeman before he joined the Bureau, took the lead. Within 3 days, we had returned our report. We felt there was no evidence this self-styled Forces of Evil was composed of 7 white men. In fact, we didn't believe it was composed of any white men. It would be a lone black male trying to divert attention away from himself and the fact that he had already murdered Gail Jackson. From his military usage of dates, for example, 1 June, and his reference to meters rather than feet or yards, it was clear he was in the military. The letters were almost illiterate, ruling out an officer who would have had a better education. From his own experience, Bob felt he would likely be either an artilleryman or a military policeman, 25 to 30 years of age. He would already have killed 2 other women, probably also prostitutes. That's what his reference to the victims will double was all about, and we thought there was some chance he might be the stocking strangler as well. When our profile was circulated around Fort Benning and the bars and nightclubs the victim was known to frequent, the Army and Columbus Police quickly came up with the name of William H. Hance, a black, 26-year-old Specialist 4, assigned to an artillery unit at the fort. He confessed to the murders of Gail Jackson, Irene Thurkield, and another woman, an Army private named Karen Hickman, at Fort Benning the previous fall. He admitted that he had made up the Forces of Evil to throw police off his track. The actual stalking strangler was identified from a photograph by a witness at one of the scenes as Carlton Gary, a 27-year-old black man who was born and raised in Columbus. He was captured after a series of restaurant holdups, but escaped and was not recaptured until May 1984. Both Hance and Gary were convicted and sentenced to die for their crimes. After the community settled back to normal, Judd Ray took a leave of absence to run a program at the University of Georgia that recruited minorities and women into law enforcement careers. Once this project was over, he planned to go back to police work. But with his military and investigative background, not to mention the fact that he was black, and at this time the Bureau desperately needed to establish itself as an equal opportunity employer, he accepted an offer from the FBI. I first met him casually when he was at Quantico for new agent training. He was then assigned to the Atlanta field office, where his experience and knowledge of the local area and people was considered a tremendous asset. We next met late in 1981, when I was down in Atlanta for AtKid. Like everyone else in the field office, Judd was deeply involved in the investigation. Each agent was part of a team working 5 AtKid cases, and Judd was working an intense schedule. He was also under tremendous pressure from another source. His marriage, shaky for some time, was breaking up. His wife had been drinking heavily, verbally abusing him, acting erratically. "I didn't even know this woman anymore," he said. Finally, one Sunday evening, he'd given her an ultimatum. Either she had to change her ways and get help, or he was going to take their 2 daughters, ages 18 months and 8 years, and leave. Much to his surprise, Judd did begin seeing positive signs. She became more attentive to him and the girls. "I saw an abrupt change in her personality. She quit boozing," he recalled. "She started doting over me. For the first time in 13 years of marriage, she got up in the morning to make me breakfast. Suddenly, she'd become all the things I wanted her to be. But then he added, I should have known this was too good to be true. And that's something I would lecture to police afterward. If your spouse suddenly shows you a radical change of behavior, negatively or positively, you ought to be suspicious right away. What was happening was that Judd's wife had already decided to have him killed, and was buying time until she could make the arrangements. If she pulled it off successfully, she would be able to avoid the trauma and humiliation of an ugly divorce, keep the two kids herself, and collect on a $250,000 life insurance policy. Far better to be the grieving and well-off widow of a murdered law officer than a divorced woman alone in the world. Unbeknownst to Judd, two men had been watching his moves and habits for several days. They waited outside his apartment building in the morning and followed him on I-20 into Atlanta every day. They were looking for the opportunity to get him defenseless, so the hit could be accomplished efficiently and a getaway made without witnesses. But they quickly realized they had a problem. Judd had been a law officer long enough that the first rule a cop learns was instinctive to him. Keep your gun hand free. No matter where the two would-be shooters tracked him, he always seemed to have his right hand ready to go for his gun. They went back to Mrs. Ray and told her the problem. They wanted to take him out in the parking lot outside the apartment, but Judd would be able to get to at least one of them before they could finish him off. She had to do something about that free right hand. Not letting a detail like this stand in her way, she got a travel coffee cup and suggested Judd take it to work with him every morning. For 13 years, she never made me or the girls breakfast, and now she was trying to get me to take that damn coffee cup with me. But he resisted. After all these years, he just couldn't get used to the idea of driving with his left hand on the wheel and his right hand occupied with a coffee cup. This was in the days before cup holders were commonplace in cars. Had they been, this story might have had a completely different outcome. The gunman came back to Mrs. Ray. We can't take him in the parking lot, one of them reported. We've got to take him inside. So the hit was scheduled for early February. Mrs. Ray had taken the two girls out for the evening, and Judd was home alone. The shooters come to the building, down the hall, and up to the apartment door where they ring the bell. The only problem is, they have the wrong apartment number. When a white man comes to the door, the two guys ask where the black man is who lives there. Innocently, he tells them they have the wrong apartment. Mr. Ray lives over there. But now, the shooters had been seen by this neighbor. If there's a hit tonight, there's no way he's not going to remember two black men asking where Judd Ray lives when the police question him. So they leave. Later, Mrs. Ray comes back home, assuming the job's been done. Hesitantly, she looks around, then crawls into the bedroom, mentally preparing for the 911 call she's going to make, saying something terrible has happened to her husband. She gets to the bedroom and sees Judd lying there on the bed. She's still creeping around. He turns over and says, "What the hell are you doing?" Whereupon she freaks out and runs to the bathroom. But in the following days, her good behavior continues, and Judd thinks she's really turned around. As naive as he thinks this was in retrospect, after many rocky years in a relationship, there's such an overwhelming desire to believe things truly have gotten better. It's 2 weeks later, February 21st, 1981. Judd is now working the murder of Patrick Baltazar. It's potentially a big break in the Atkid investigation because hair and fiber found on the 12-year-old's body appear to match specimens found on previous victims of the child killer. That night, Judd's wife makes him an Italian dinner. What he doesn't know is that she's heavily laced the spaghetti sauce with phenobarbital. as planned, she takes the two girls with her and goes to visit her aunt. Later on, Judd's home alone in the bedroom. He thinks he hears something coming from the front of the apartment. The light in the hallway changes, goes dim. Someone's unscrewed the light bulb in his older daughter's bedroom. Then he hears muffled voices down the hall. What's happened is that the first shooter's lost his nerve. The two of them are discussing what to do now. He doesn't know how they've gotten in, but it doesn't matter at the moment. They're here. "Who is it?" Judd calls out. Suddenly a shot rips out, but it misses him. Judd dives for the floor, but a second bullet hits him in the left arm. It's still dark. He's trying to hide behind the king-size bed. "Who is this?" he calls out. "What do you want?" A third shot hits the bed close to him. In his mind, he's going through this intuitive survival drill, trying to figure out what kind of gun it is. If it's a Smith & Wesson, they've got three shots left. If it's a Colt, they've only got two. "Hey, man," he yells, "what's wrong? Why are you trying to kill me? Take what you want and get out. I haven't seen you. Just don't kill me." There's no reply. But now Judd can see him, silhouetted against the moonlight. "You're going to die tonight," Judd acknowledges to himself. "No way you're going to get out of this. But you know what it's like. You don't want detectives walking in here tomorrow and saying, 'This poor bastard never put up a fight. He just let them come in and execute him.'" Judd resolves that when the detectives see the scene, they're going to know he fucking fought this guy. The first thing he's got to do is get to his gun, which is on the floor on the other side of the bed. But a king-size bed represents a lot of real estate to cover when there's someone trying to kill you. Then he hears, "Don't move, you motherfucker." In the darkness, he climbs back up and begins inching toward the edge of the bed and his gun. He gets closer, agonizingly slowly, but he needs more leverage to make the final move effectively. When he's got all four fingers gripping the edge, he whirls off onto the floor, but lands with his right hand under his chest. And since he's been shot in his left arm, he doesn't have enough power in his left hand to reach for the gun. Just then, the shooter jumps on the bed. He shoots Judd at point-blank range.
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
He feels as if he's just been kicked by a mule. Something inside him seems to collapse on itself. He doesn't know the technical details at the time, but the bullet has gone through his back, knocked out his right lung, penetrated the third intercostal space between his ribs, and ripped out the front of his chest into his right hand, which he's still lying on. The shooter jumps down off the bed, stands over him, feels his pulse. "There, you motherfucker," he declares, and walks out. Judd's in shock. He's lying on the floor, hyperventilating. He doesn't know where he is or what's happening to him. Then he realizes he must be back in combat in Vietnam. He can smell the smoke, see the muzzle blasts, but he can't breathe. He thinks, "Maybe I'm not really in Nam. Maybe I'm just dreaming I am. But if I'm dreaming, why is it so hard to breathe?" He struggles to get up. He staggers over to the television and turns it on. Maybe that'll tell him if he's dreaming. Johnny Carson and The Tonight Show come on. He reaches out and touches the screen, trying to tell if it's real, leaving a streak of wet blood across the glass. He needs to get some water. He makes his way to the bathroom, turns on the tap, and tries to cup the water in his hand. That's when he sees the bullet embedded in his right hand and the blood streaming from his chest. Now he knows what's happened to him. He goes back out into the bedroom, lies down at the foot of the bed, and waits to die. But he's been a cop too long. He can't let himself go this quietly. When the detectives come the next day, they've got to see that he struggled. He gets up again, makes his way to the phone, and dials 0. When the operator comes on, he gasps for air, tells her that he's an FBI agent and that he's been shot. Immediately, she puts him through to DeKalb County Police Department. A young female officer comes on the line. Judd tells her that he's FBI and he's been shot, but he can barely get the words out. He's been drugged. He's lost a lot of blood. His speech is slurred. "What do you mean, you're FBI?" she challenges. Judd hears her yell to her sergeant that there's some drunk on the line claiming he's with the FBI. What does the sergeant want her to do? The sergeant tells her she can hang up. Then the operator breaks in, telling them he's for real and that they've got to send emergency help immediately. She won't let them off until they agree. "That operator saved my life," Judd told me later. He passed out when she broke in and didn't regain consciousness until the emergency medical team was putting the oxygen mask over his face. "Don't prepare him for shock," he hears the team leader say. "He's not going to make it." But they take him to DeKalb General Hospital, where there's a thoracic surgeon on duty. And as he's lying there on the gurney in the emergency room, as the doctors frantically try to save his life, he knows. With the clarity that comes from a close encounter with death, he's saying to himself, "This isn't a reprisal. I've put a lot of people in jail, but they couldn't get that close. The only person who could get that close to me is someone that I trusted implicitly." When he comes out of surgery and is taken to the intensive care unit, the Atlanta SAC, John Glover, is there. Glover's been bearing the weight of AtKid for months, and now this. Like the dead children and like Judd, Glover is also black, one of the highest-ranking blacks in the Bureau. He feels enormously for Judd. "Find my wife," Judd whispers to him. "Make her tell you what happened." Glover thinks Judd's still delirious, but the doctor says no. He's conscious and alert. Judd spends 21 days in the hospital, his hospital room under armed guard, since no one knows who these shooters are or whether they're coming back to finish him off. Meanwhile, his case is going nowhere. His wife expresses shock and dismay over what happened and thanks God he wasn't killed. If only she'd been there that night. In the office, a team of agents are tracking down leads. Judd's been a cop for a long time. He could have a lot of enemies. Once it's clear he's going to recover, the question is phrased in a lighter vein, in terms of the popular TV series Dallas, "Who Shot J.R.?" It's a couple of months before he can get his routine back to normal. He finally tackles the stack of bills that have been piling up since the attack. He moans as he faces a Southern Bell telephone bill for more than $300. But as he starts going through it, he begins putting the case together in his mind. The next day, he comes into the office and says he thinks this phone bill is the key. As the victim, he's not supposed to be working his own case, but his colleagues listen. Listed on the bill are a bunch of calls back to Columbus. From the phone company, they get the name and address that go with the number. Judd doesn't even know this guy. So he and several other agents get in the car and drive the 100 miles down to Columbus. Their destination is the home of a preacher who, Judd decides, is actually more of a snake oil salesman. The FBI agents lean on him, but he denies having anything to do with the attempted murder. The agents aren't going to let him off easily. This is one of our own, they tell him, and we're going to get the person or persons who did this. Then the story begins to emerge. This preacher is known around Columbus as a man who can get things done. Mrs. Ray had approached him to do the job back in October, but he says he told her he wouldn't do it. She answers that she'll find someone who will, and asks to use the phone, saying she'll pay him back for the long-distance calls. The preacher tells the agents she called back to an old neighbor in Atlanta, who'd been in the Army in Vietnam the same time as Judd and knew his way around a gun. She tells him, "We've got to get this thing done." And to top it all off, the preacher claims, "Mrs. Ray stiffed me for the phone calls." The agents get in the car and drive back to Atlanta, where they confront the former neighbor. Under grilling, he admits Mrs. Ray asked him about a contract killing, but he swears he had no idea it was Judd she was trying to get. Anyway, he says he told her he didn't know anybody who did that sort of thing, and put her in touch with his brother-in-law, who might. The brother-in-law, in turn, introduces her to another guy who agrees to take on the job, and hires two other men to be the shooters. Mrs. Ray, the former neighbor's brother-in-law, the man who took the contract, and the two shooters are all indicted. The former neighbor is named an unindicted co-conspirator. The five charged are found guilty of attempted murder, conspiracy, and burglary. They each get a 10-year sentence, the most the judge can give them. I would see Judd from time to time in relation to Atkid. Before long, he began seeking me out. Since I wasn't one of his colleagues in the office, but knew what the stress of the job was all about, and could understand what he'd been through and continued to go through, I guess he felt he could talk to me. In addition to all the other feelings that go with such a thing, he told me he found the public airing of his domestic situation very painful and embarrassing. With all Judd suffered, the Bureau wanted to do whatever was best for him and thought that transferring him to another field office far from Atlanta would help him recover. But after talking with Judd and sharing his feelings, I didn't think so. I thought he should stay where he was for a while. I went in and spoke to John Glover, the SAC in Atlanta. I said, "If you transfer him, you're eliminating the support system he has right here in this office. He needs to stay here. Let him spend a year getting his children settled again and close to the aunt who helped raise him." I suggested that if he was going to go anywhere, it should be to the Columbus Resident Agency, since he'd been a cop there and still knew most of the force. They did keep him in the Atlanta-Columbus area, where he began to get his life back in order. Then he moved to the New York field office, where his main job was foreign counterintelligence. He also became one of the office's profile coordinators, the liaison between the local police and my unit at Quantico. When slots became available in the unit, we brought Judd on, along with Roseanne Russo, also from New York, and Jim Wright, from the Washington field office, who had spent more than a year working the John Hinckley case and trial. Roseanne eventually left the unit for the Washington field office and foreign counterintelligence. Judd and Jim both became distinguished and internationally known members of the team and close friends of mine. When I became unit chief, Jim Wright took over from me as manager of the profiling program. Judd claimed to have been shocked that we picked him, but he'd been an outstanding coordinator in New York, and because of his strong law enforcement background, he worked out right from the beginning. He was a quick learner and extremely analytical. As a police officer, he'd seen these cases from the trenches and brought that perspective to them. When it would come up in a teaching situation, Judd wouldn't be afraid to mention the attempt on his life and its repercussions. He even had a tape recording of his emergency telephone call, which he would sometimes play for a class. But he couldn't stand to be in the room. He would step outside until it was over. I told him, "Judd, this is a tremendous thing." I explained that so many of the elements at the scene, the footprints, the blood on the television, would have been misleading or nonsensical. Now we were beginning to understand how seemingly irrational elements can have a rational explanation. "If you work this case up," I told him, "it could be an extremely valuable teaching tool." He did that, and it became one of the most interesting and informative cases we taught. And it became a catharsis for him. I found it quite a personal revelation. In the process of preparing to teach, I'd go down an alleyway I'd never ventured into before. Every time you talk about it to people you can trust, you explore another alley. Contract spouse killings and attempts happen more frequently in this country than we'd like to believe, and the family is often so embarrassed that no one will talk about it. Watching Judd teach this case has been among my most moving experiences as an academy instructor, and I know I'm not alone. Eventually, he got to the point where he would stay and listen when the emergency tape was played. By the time Judd became part of my unit, I'd already done a fair amount of research on post-offense behavior. It had become clear to me that no matter how hard he tries, much of what the offender does after the crime is beyond his conscious control. As a result of his own case, Judd became very interested in the issue of pre-offense behavior. For a while, we'd understood the importance of precipitating stressors as distinct events leading to the commission of a crime. But Judd expanded the unit's horizons considerably and demonstrated how important it is to focus on the behavior and interpersonal actions before a crime takes place. A radical or even subtle but significant change in a partner's behavior can mean that he or she has already begun to plan for a change in the status quo. If the husband or wife becomes unexpectedly calm or much more friendly and accepting than before, it can mean he or she has already come to regard that change as inevitable or imminent. Contract spouse killings are difficult to investigate. The survivor has laid the emotional groundwork well. The only way to crack these cases is to get someone to talk, and you have to understand the dynamics of the situation and what really happened to be authoritative in this. As much as the rearrangement of a crime scene can lead the police in the wrong direction, a spouse's pre-offense behavior is a form of staging. More than anything else, Judd's case is an object lesson for us on how you can misinterpret behavior at a crime scene. If Judd had died, we would have come to some wrong conclusions. One of the first things a rookie cop is taught is not to contaminate a crime scene. But by his own barely conscious actions, veteran cop and special agent that he was, Judd inadvertently contaminated his own crime scene. We would have interpreted all of the footprints and evidence of his movement to have been a burglary that went bad, that the intruders had walked him around the room, forcing him to tell them where particular items were hidden. The blood on the TV screen would have suggested that Judd had been lying in bed watching television when he'd been surprised and immediately shot. The most important consideration, as Judd told me, was that if I had died, I'm absolutely convinced she would have gotten away with it. It was well planned, and her actions had prepped everyone in the neighborhood. She would have been completely believable as the grieving spouse. As I said, Judd and I became close friends. He's probably the closest thing to a brother I've ever had. I used to joke that he would make sure to play the tape for me right around performance rating time, to assure the full measure of my sympathy. Fortunately, though, that was never necessary. Judd Ray's record speaks for itself. He's now chief of the International Training Unit, where his skill and experience will benefit a new generation of agents and policemen and policewomen. But wherever he goes, he will always be one of our own and one of the best. one of the few law officers around to survive an attempt on his life through character and sheer force of will, and then to bring the culprits to justice himself. Chapter 13. The Most Dangerous Game. In 1924, the author Richard Connell wrote a short story entitled The Most Dangerous Game. It was about a big game hunter named General Zaroff, who had tired of pursuing animals and had begun hunting a much more challenging and intelligent prey, human beings. It's still a popular story. My daughter Lauren read it recently in school. As far as we know, until about 1980, Connell's tale remained in the realm of fiction. But its status changed with a mild-mannered baker in Anchorage, Alaska, named Robert Hansen. We didn't profile Hansen or devise a strategy to identify and catch him according to our usual procedure. In September 1983, by the time my unit was called in, Alaska state troopers had already identified Hansen as a murder suspect. But they weren't sure of the extent of his crimes, or whether such an unlikely individual, a respectable family man and pillar of the community, was capable of the terrible things of which he was being accused. What had happened was this. The previous June 13th, a young woman had run frantically to an Anchorage police officer. She had a pair of handcuffs dangling from one wrist and told an extraordinary story. She was a 17-year-old prostitute who'd been approached on the street by a short, pockmarked man with red hair who had offered her $200 for oral sex in his car. She said that while she was performing, he slipped a handcuff on her wrist and pulled out a gun, then drove her to his house in the fashionable Muldoon area of the city. No one else was home. He told her that if she cooperated and did what he asked, he wouldn't hurt her. But then he forced her to strip naked, raped her, and inflicted severe pain by biting her nipples and thrusting a hammer into her vagina. While he still had her handcuffed to a pole in his basement and immobilized, he slept for several hours. When he awoke, he told her that he liked her so much that he was going to fly her in his private airplane out to his cabin in the woods, where they'd have sex again, and then he'd fly her back to Anchorage, where he would free her. But she knew the chances of that were pretty remote. He'd raped and assaulted her, and hadn't done anything to hide his identity. If he got her into that cabin, she'd be in real trouble. At the airport, while her kidnapper was loading supplies into the plane, she managed to escape. She ran as fast as she could, looking for help. That was when she found the policeman. From the description she gave, her kidnapper appeared to be Robert Hansen. He was in his mid-40s, had grown up in Iowa, and had been in the Anchorage area for 17 years, where he ran a successful bakery and was considered a prominent member of the community. He was married, with a daughter and a son. The police drove her to Hansen's house in Muldoon, which she said was where she'd been tortured. They took her to the airport, and she identified the Piper Super Cub that belonged to Robert Hansen. The police then went to Hansen and confronted him with the young woman's charges. He responded with outrage, saying he had never met her, and asserted that because of his prominence, she was obviously trying to shake him down for money. The very idea was ridiculous. "You can't rape a prostitute, can you?" he said to police. And he had an alibi for the night in question. His wife and two children were in Europe for the summer, and he was home having dinner with two business associates. He gave their names, and they corroborated his story. Police had no evidence on him, just the young woman's word, so he wasn't arrested or charged. But though they lacked proof, both the Anchorage police and Alaska State Trooper's office smelled smoke and knew a fire was out there somewhere. Back in 1980, construction workers had been excavating on Eklutna Road when they came upon the partial remains of a woman. Her body had been partly eaten by bears and bore the signs of having been stabbed to death and buried in a shallow grave. Known only as Eklutna Annie, she'd never been identified, and her killer had never been caught. Later in the year, the body of Joanne Messina was discovered in a gravel pit near Seward. Then, in September 1982, hunters near the Knik River found the body of 23-year-old Sherry Morrow in a shallow grave. She was a topless dancer who'd been missing since the previous November. She'd been shot 3 times. Shell casings found at the scene identified the bullets as coming from a .223 Ruger Mini 14, a high-powered hunting rifle. Unfortunately, it was a common weapon in Alaska, so it would have been difficult to track down and interview every hunter who owned one. But one peculiar aspect to the case was that no bullet holes were in her clothing, indicating she must have been naked when shot. Almost exactly a year later, another body was discovered in a shallow grave along the bank of the Knik. This time it was Paula Golding, an out-of-work secretary who had rather desperately taken a job in a topless bar to make ends meet. She'd also been shot with a Ruger Mini 14. She'd gone missing in April, and since then, the 17-year-old prostitute had been abducted and escaped. Now, with Golding to add to the list of unsolved crimes, the Criminal Investigation Bureau of the Alaska State Trooper's Office decided they'd better follow up on Mr. Hansen. Even though the police had a suspect before I heard about him, I wanted to make sure my judgment wouldn't be clouded by the investigative work already done. So before I let them give me the specifics on their man during our first phone conference, I said, "First, tell me about the crimes, and let me tell you about the guy." They described the unsolved murders and the details of the young woman's story. I described a scenario and an individual they said sounded very much like their suspect, down to the stuttering. Then they told me about Hansen, his job and family, his position in the community, his reputation as an outstanding game hunter. Did this sound like the kind of guy who could be capable of these crimes? He sure did, I told them. The problem was, while they had a lot of second-hand information, they just didn't have physical evidence to charge him. The only way to get him off the street, which they were extremely anxious to do, was to get a confession. They asked me to come on scene and help them develop their case. In a sense, this was the opposite of what we normally do in that we were working with a known subject, trying to determine whether his background, personality, and behavior fit a set of crimes. I brought along Jim Horn, who'd recently joined my unit from the Boulder, Colorado resident agency. We'd gone through new agents' training together back in the old days, and when I finally got authorization for 4 agents to work with me, I'd asked Jim to come back to Quantico. Along with Jim Reese, Jim Horn is now one of the 2 top stress management experts in the Bureau, a critical function in our line of work. But in 1983, this was one of his first cases on the behavioral side. Getting to Anchorage was one of the more exciting and least pleasurable business trips I've had. It ended up with a red-eye, white-knuckle flight over water. When we arrived, the police picked us up and took us to our hotel. On the way, we passed some of the bars where the victims had worked. It was too cold most of the time for hookers to work outside, so they made their business connections in the bars, which were open practically 24 hours a day. They closed for maybe an hour to clean up and sweep out the drunks. At the time, largely as a result of the huge transient population that came in for the construction of the oil pipeline, Alaska had among the highest rates in the country of suicide, alcoholism, and venereal disease. It had very much become the modern version of our Wild West frontier. I found the entire atmosphere very strange. There appeared to be an ongoing conflict between the native people and those who had come over from the lower 48. You had all these macho men walking around with big tattoos and looking as if they'd come straight out of a Marlboro ad. With the great distances people had to travel, it seemed as though almost everyone had an airplane, so Hansen wasn't unusual in that respect. What was significant to us about this case was that it was the first time profiling was used to support a search warrant. We began analyzing everything we knew about the crimes and about Robert Hansen. As far as victimology was concerned, the known victims had been prostitutes or topless dancers. They were part of a great crop of available victims who traveled up and down the West Coast. Because they were so transient, and because prostitutes are not in the habit of reporting their whereabouts to the police, it was difficult to know if anything had happened to any one of them until a body turned up. This was exactly the same problem the police and FBI faced with the Green River Killer down in Washington State. So the choice of victims was highly significant. The murderer was targeting only women who would not be missed. We didn't know everything about Hansen's background, but what we did know fit into a pattern. He was short and slight, heavily pockmarked, and spoke with a severe stutter. I surmised that he had had severe skin problems as a teenager, and between that and the speech impediment, was probably teased or shunned by his peers, particularly girls. So his self-esteem would have been low. That might also have been why he moved to Alaska. The idea of a new start in a new frontier. And psychologically speaking, abusing prostitutes is a pretty standard way of getting back at women in general. I also made much of the fact that Hansen was known as a proficient hunter. He'd made a local reputation for himself by taking down a wild doll sheep with a crossbow while hunting in the Kuskokwim Mountains. I don't mean to imply that most hunters are inadequate types, but in my experience, if you have an inadequate type to begin with, one of the ways he might try to compensate is by hunting or playing around with guns or knives. The severe stutter reminded me of David Carpenter, San Francisco's trailside killer. As in Carpenter's case, I was betting that Hansen's speech problem disappeared when he felt most dominant and in control. Putting this all together, even though this was a scenario we'd never seen before, I was beginning to get an image of what I thought was going on. Prostitutes and exotic dancers had been found dead in remote wooded areas of gunshot wounds suggestive of those made with a hunting rifle. In at least one case, the shots had been fired at an undressed body. The 17-year-old who said she'd escaped claimed Robert Hansen wanted to fly her to his cabin in the woods. Hansen had packed his wife and children off to Europe for the summer and was home alone. It was my belief that, like General Zaroff in The Most Dangerous Game, Robert Hansen had tired of elk and bear and doll sheep and turned his attention to a more interesting prey. Zaroff explained that he used captured sailors who shipwrecked on the intentionally unmarked rocks in the channel leading to his island. "I hunt the scum of the earth. Sailors from tramp ships. A thoroughbred horse or hound is worth more than a score of them." Hansen, I was surmising, regarded prostitutes in much the same way. They were people he could regard as lower and more worthless than himself. And he wouldn't need the gift of gab to get one to come with him. He would pick her up, make her his prisoner, fly her out into the wilderness, strip her naked, let her loose, then hunt her down with a gun or knife. His M.O. wouldn't have started this way. He would have started simply by killing the early ones, then using the plane to fly their bodies far away. These were crimes of anger. He would have gotten off on having his victims beg for their lives. Being a hunter, at a certain point, it would have occurred to him that he could combine these various activities by flying them out into the wilderness alive, then hunting them down for sport and further sexual gratification. This would have been the ultimate control, and it would have become addictive. He would want to do it again and again. And this led me to the details of the search warrant. What they wanted from Jim and me was an affidavit they could take to court, explaining what profiling was all about, what we would expect to find in the search, and our rationale for being able to say so. Unlike a common criminal or someone whose gun is an interchangeable tool, Hansen's hunting rifle would be important to him. Therefore, I predicted the rifle would be somewhere in his house, though not in open view. It would be in a crawl space, behind paneling or a false wall, hidden in the attic, someplace like that. I also predicted our guy would be a saver, though not entirely for the normal reasons. A lot of sexual killers take souvenirs from their victims and give them to the women in their lives as a sign of dominance and a way of being able to relive the experience. But Hansen couldn't very well put a woman's head on the wall the way he would a big game animal's, so I thought it likely he would take some other kind of trophy. Since there was no evidence of human mutilation on the bodies, I expected him to have taken jewelry, which he would have given to his wife or daughter, making up a story about where the piece came from. He didn't appear to have kept the victim's underwear or any other item we could account for, but he might have kept small photographs or something else from a wallet. And from my experience with this type of personality, I thought we might find a journal or list documenting his exploits. The next order of business was cracking his alibi. It was no big deal for his two business associates to say they were with him the night in question, if nothing was at stake for them. If we could create some high stakes, however, that could change things. Anchorage police got the district attorney to authorize a grand jury to investigate the abduction and assault of the young prostitute, who'd identified Hansen. The businessmen were then approached by the police and asked to give their stories again. Only this time, they were informed that if they were found to be lying to the grand jury, they'd each be facing hard time. As we'd anticipated, that was enough to break things open. Both men admitted they'd not been with Hansen that night, that he'd asked them to help him out of what he characterized as an awkward situation. So Hansen was arrested on charges of kidnapping and rape. A search warrant of his home was immediately executed. There, police found the Ruger Mini 14 rifle. Ballistics tests matched it to the shell casings found near the bodies. As we'd figured, Hansen had a well-outfitted trophy room where he watched television, full of animal heads, walrus tusks, horns and antlers, mounted birds, and skins on the floor. Under the floorboards in the attic, they found more weapons and various cheap items of jewelry belonging to the victims. One of these was a Timex watch. He'd given other items to his wife and daughter. They also found a driver's license and other ID cards from some of the dead women. They didn't come across a journal, but they did find the equivalent, an aviation map marked with where he had left various bodies. All of this evidence, of course, was enough to make a case to nail him. But without the warrant, we wouldn't have had it. And the only way we could get a warrant in this instance was to demonstrate to a judge's satisfaction that there was sufficient behavioral evidence to justify a search. We have successfully aided in search warrant affidavits leading to arrests many times since then, perhaps most notably in the Delaware case of Stephen Pennell, the I-40 killer, who was executed in 1992 for torturing and killing women he picked up in his specially outfitted van. By the time Anchorage police and Alaska state troopers actually interrogated Robert Hansen in February 1984, I was home recovering from my collapse in Seattle. Roy Hazelwood, who was heroically covering for me while still handling all his own work, coached the police on interview techniques. As he had when police first confronted him with the abduction charge, Hansen denied everything. He pointed to his happy home life and his success in business. At first he claimed that the reason shells from his rifle had been found at various sites was that he'd had been there and practiced his shooting. Apparently, the presence of dead bodies at each of the locations was merely coincidental. But eventually, faced with a mountain of evidence and the prospect of an angry prosecutor seeking the death penalty if he didn't come clean, he admitted to the murders. In trying to rationalize and justify himself, he claimed that he only wanted oral sex from the prostitutes he picked up, something he didn't feel he should ask from his proper, respectable wife. If the hooker satisfied him, he said, that would be that. The ones who didn't comply, who tried to control the situation, those were the ones he punished. In this way, Hansen's behavior mirrored what we learned in our prison interview with Monty Rissell. Both Hansen and Rissell were inadequate types with bad backgrounds. The women who received the worst of Rissell's wrath were the ones who tried to feign friendship or enjoyment to placate him. What they didn't realize was that for this type of individual, the power and domination of the situation is everything. Hansen also asserted that 30 to 40 prostitutes had gone with him willingly in his plane, and that he had brought them back alive. I found this proposition hard to believe. The class of prostitutes Hansen picked up are in business to turn a quick trick and move on to the next customer. If they've been in the business for any time, they're generally pretty good assessors of people. They're not willingly going to take a plane ride into the country with some John they've just met. If they made a mistake with him, it would be in letting him convince them to come with him to his house. Once he got them inside, it was too late. Like his fictional counterpart, General Zaroff, Hansen stated that he hunted and killed only a certain class of people. He would never consider hurting a decent woman, but felt that prostitutes and topless or nude dancers were fair game. "I'm not saying I hate all women, I don't, but I guess prostitutes are women I'm putting down as lower than myself. It's like it was a game. They had to pitch the ball before I could bat." Once he started his hunting, the killing became anticlimactic. The excitement, Hansen told interrogators, was in the stalking. He confirmed our suspicions about his background. He'd grown up in Pocahontas, Iowa, where his father was a baker. Robert was a shoplifter as a child, and long after he reached adulthood and could afford to buy what he wanted, he still stole for the thrill of it. His trouble with girls started in high school, he said. He resented the fact that his stuttering and bad acne kept people away from him. "Because I looked and talked like a freak, every time I looked at a girl, she would run away." He had an uneventful stint in the army, then married when he was 22. There followed a string of arson and burglary convictions, separation and divorce from his wife, and remarriage. He moved to Alaska upon his second wife's graduation from college. There he could make a new start. But his troubles with the law continued for several more years, including repeated assault charges against women who apparently rejected his advances. Interestingly, like so many of the others, he drove a VW Beetle at the time. On February 27, 1984, Hansen pled guilty to 4 counts of murder, 1 of rape, 1 of kidnapping, and assorted theft and weapons charges. He was sentenced to 499 years in prison. One of the questions we'd had to answer in the Hansen case before police knew how to proceed was whether all of the noted prostitute and topless dancer deaths in Anchorage had been or could have been committed by the same individual. This is often a critical issue in criminal investigative analysis. Just about the time the body of Robert Hansen's first victim was discovered in Alaska, I'd been called by the Buffalo, New York Police Department to evaluate a string of vicious, apparently racially hate-based murders. On September 22, 1980, a 14-year-old boy named Glenn Dunn was shot and killed in the parking lot of a supermarket. Witnesses described the gunman as a young white male. The next day, Harold Green, 32, was shot at a fast food restaurant in suburban Cheektowaga. That same night, 30-year-old Emmanuel Thomas was killed in front of his own house, in the same neighborhood as the previous day's murder. And the next day, another man, Joseph McCoy, was killed in Niagara Falls. As far as anyone could tell, only 2 factors linked these senseless murders. All the victims were black men, and all had been killed by .22-caliber bullets, prompting the press to bestow an instant title, the .22-caliber killer. Racial tension ran high in Buffalo. Many in the black community felt helpless and accused the police of doing nothing to protect them. In some ways, it seemed to mirror the horror taking place in Atlanta. And as so often happens in these situations, things didn't immediately get better. They got worse.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 7 of Mindhunter. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 8.